Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Tomorrow, the 26th of January, is the 150th anniversary of the founding of the Rugby Football Union. And by a complex twist of fate, this is also the 150th episode of Rugby Reloaded. To mark these two momentous anniversaries, this week's episode is going to look at how the Rugby Football Union was created and highlight some of the contemporary echoes that can be found in the events of 150 years ago. In January 1871, the rugby version of football stood unchallenged as the leading version of the game throughout Britain and Ireland. Such was its popularity amongst the footballing public that Bell's Life, the premier sporting weekly of the time, pointed out that since 1863, the year the Football Association was founded, every year has increased the superiority in point of numbers and popularity of the rugby clubs over those who are subject to the rule of the association. How had rugby eclipsed the Football Association and the other types of football? Although it's tempting to speculate about what was the most attractive code of football, the formation of the RFU shows that there is a lot more to a sport's popularity than merely the contents of its rulebook. In fact, until the formation of the RFU, rugby didn't even have a rulebook. Adult clubs played their own version of rugby school rules, often adding to or disposing of sections of the school's rules as they wanted. Rugby's popularity was, in fact, in large part due to the tremendous public profile generated for the game by the success of the best-selling book Tom Brown's School Days, alongside which was the supreme self-confidence of rugby supporters, who believed that their game alone was the very embodiment of the muscular Christian moral principles of rugby school headmaster Thomas Arnold. Indeed, rugby football was unique in that, alone of all the other public school codes of football, it was a school game that was popular with adults. The Eton, Harrow and other school versions of football did not become adult sports. Outside of one or two teams at Oxford or Cambridge universities, there were no adult clubs which played Eton or Harrow football. So while the Old Etonian and Harrovian footballers were ready to sink their differences to play association football, the Old Rugbeians stood firm in their absolute belief in the superiority of their brand of the game. So self-confident were they that they not only refused to join the FA, but they also believed that rugby football did not even need an organisation. This supreme self-belief only began to be questioned in 1870 when, just as today in the 21st century, concerns began to be expressed about the safety of rugby. The need to make the sport less dangerous was one of the two decisive factors which led to the creation of the Rugby Football Union. In November 1870, the Times published a letter from a surgeon complaining that he had treated numerous injuries suffered by schoolboys during football matches at rugby school. He blamed them all on hacking, as kicking the shins of the opposing players was called. As might be expected, current and former pupils rushed to rugby's defence. Some disputed the facts of the surgeon's claims. Others simply defended hacking. One old rugbyan called the brutal kicking of shins entirely legitimate. He argued that a new evil has arisen, and to prevent this evil, known as that of mauling, whereby the ball was shielded from the defending side by forwards, a certain amount of hacking is absolutely necessary to free the ball. To modern ears, this sounds very much like how raking opponents with studs in the ruck to get the ball back in play was justified in later years. In early December 1870, this public disquiet reached such heights that rugby school's medical officer, Dr. Robert Farquharson, felt compelled to write to the Times to admit that a boy had indeed been killed during a match at the school. However, the cause of death was not hacking, but an abdominal injury caused by a collision with another player. Hacking, the doctor claimed, was not responsible for any major injuries. For the first time, rugby football was being publicly criticised. And this criticism could not be dismissed as the carping of rival schools, not least because many adult rugby clubs were also highly critical of hacking. In London, a number of teams had abandoned hacking by 1866. Led by Richmond and supported by Blackheath, then the two most prestigious clubs in London, many middle-class young men who played the game found that bloodied and bruised shins acquired on a Saturday afternoon were not ideal preparation for work on the following Monday morning. Rugby, many inside the game felt, should put its house in order. At the same time as the game was squirming uncomfortably in the public spotlight, it also found itself challenged by an unexpected source, the Football Association. This would be the second crucial factor that led to the formation of the RFU. In March 1870, England had played Scotland for the first time in an unofficial soccer international at the Kennington Oval in London. It resulted in a 1-1 draw and was such a success that another match was played in November. This ended in a 1-0 defeat for Scotland and led to a wave of complaints about the match by Scottish rugby followers. In the first match, Scotland had fielded just one Scottish-born player. The team in the second had just three. Charles Nepean, who had played for the Scots in the second match, qualified for selection because his cousin was married to a Scot. What's more, rugby followers also denied that soccer was an authentically Scottish game. But what really rankled was that the soccer team could not defeat the English. So in the second week of December 1870, the captains of five leading Scottish rugby clubs issued a challenge to any team selected from the whole of England to players in a match, 20-a-side, rugby rules, either in Glasgow or Edinburgh, on any day during the present season. They argued that almost all of the leading clubs in Scotland play the rugby code and the football power of the old country was not properly represented in the late so-called international football match. But if an international rugby match was to be played, a governing body was also required to organise it. So, in December 1870, Blackheath secretary Benjamin Burns and his Richmond counterpart Edwin Ashe published a letter in Bell's Life which read, "An opinion has for some time prevailed among the supporters of rugby football that some fixed code of rules should be adopted by all clubs who profess to play the rugby game. Each club plays according to its own rules on its own ground, and consequently, confusion and disputes are generally the result. We therefore hope that all clubs playing the rugby game will join with us in framing a code of rules to be generally adopted." It ended with an appeal for all those in agreement with its contents to contact the authors, who would arrange a meeting to establish such a code. The sense of common purpose which existed in the rugby fraternity can be gauged by the fact that, while it took the FA six long meetings to reach a somewhat hollow agreement, the meeting that created the Rugby Football Union on the 26th of January 1871 lasted just 2 hours. The 32 delegates representing 21 clubs at the meeting agreed a constitution and appointed a subcommittee of three, all former pupils of rugby school, to draw up the grandiosely titled Laws of the Game. The committee reported back promptly, and in June a set of rules was agreed. To answer those who thought that rugby was too violent, Law 57 of the new rulebook outlawed all forms of hacking, while Law 58 banned the use of projecting nails, iron plates or gutta percha on boots. However, it was also understood that clubs could make their own mutual arrangements before matches and allow hacking if they both agreed. The formal ban on hacking was not the only difference with the rules of rugby school, which continued to allow players to gash each other's shins. The new RFU rules had no place for the school's convoluted process of converting tries into goals, which vaguely resembled goal-kicking in modern American football, and there were other minor variations to the offside and line-out rules. In fact, rugby school itself would not join the RFU for another 2 decades. The men elected to the RFU's first committee came from a narrow stratum of South East England's professional upper-middle classes. All 14 committee members had attended public school. 6 went to rugby and the others to Wellington, Tonbridge, Lancing and Marlborough. Of the 12 whose occupations we know, 7 were solicitors, 2 were brokers and the others a doctor, accountant and a military instructor. All but one lived in London, and of the 9 for whom we have dates of birth, the eldest was 29 and the youngest 20. In essence, this was a young gentleman's club, one of the many that were created in mid-Victorian Britain. The new organisation achieved its goals. International matches between England and Scotland became a highlight of the winter sports calendar, and the fears about the safety of rugby soon melted away. By 1875, the RFU was staging regular internationals against Scotland and Ireland, organising an annual North versus South match, and had a membership which had grown quickly to 113 clubs, 21 of them in the north of England. For the Victorian middle-class gentlemen who had founded the RFU and nurtured the sport, it seemed they had very little to worry about. Yet just 10 years later, the RFU was being threatened externally by the rise of soccer and its cup competitions and challenged internally by the rise of working-class players. And the supreme self-confidence of its founders would eventually become the Rugby Football Union's greatest weakness. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. As I'm sure you know, my Twitter handle is @ColinsTony and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, along with the show notes and links for this episode. Until next week, thanks for listening.